Good morning, everyone. And on behalf of the Office of Community Engagement, welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. Before we begin this morning, I would like to acknowledge with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous peoples of whose ancestral land Syracuse University now stands. This morning, I'm your moderator, Sydney Johnson, and pleased to be here with you. Thursday Morning Roundtable is a weekly public forum hosted by Syracuse University and the Office of Community Engagement that features prominent newsmakers and experts in our region to discuss current events in Central New York. This morning, we're very pleased to have with us today Britton Plowday. He is a faculty member at Syracuse University. Britton received a PhD in physics from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2000, studying properties of superconducting films and magnetic fields. From 2000 to 2004, Britton was a postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, where he worked on experiments with superconducting quantum circuits. In 2005, he joined the Department of Physics at Syracuse University, where he runs a low temperature research lab. The Plowday Research Group currently has 9 graduate students and 1 postdoctoral student investigating various aspects of superconducting circuits for quantum information processing. His research efforts have been supported by the Army Research Office. And now I'm going to throw a lot of initials here, but Britton will explain. IARPA, DARPA, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, and the National Science Foundation. Professor Plowday received a career award from NSF in 2006 and an IBM faculty award in 2011. From 2013 to 2019, he was the editor-in-chief for the IEEE Transactions on Applied Superconductivity. And for the past year, he has been editor-in-chief for the IEEE Transactions on Quantum Engineering. So if you will join me in welcoming Britton Plowday.
Okay, well, thank you, Sydney. So I'm Britton Plowday, and I'm happy to be here today. And it's great to see all of you logged in, 8 a.m. on a Thursday morning. And so I'm going to try to tell you today about the field of quantum information science and the goal of trying to build a quantum computer. Tell you a little bit about what the field is and what a quantum computer is and why we should be interested in building one. And then I'll tell you something about how the field has evolved and specifically what's happening here at Syracuse University in this area. And then a little more broadly, what's happening in the region around Central New York and why this region seems to be particularly primed to have a really strong impact in this field in the future. Okay, so you've heard a little bit about me already. So quantum computing fits into this broader field that I'll call quantum information science. And so this is a relatively new field. It's only been around for the past few decades. And so the idea is to try to build a computer that can process information, but where the individual objects that are running inside of that computer follow the laws of quantum mechanics. So if we contrast this with a conventional computer, like what's in all of our phones or laptops or desktops or iPads, those are what we'll refer to today as classical computers. Those are digital systems. So deep in the heart of those processors is a chip that's built out of lots and lots of transistors. Those transistors are acting as digital bits for that processor. And so each bit can only be in two different states. It can either be a zero or a one. And so it processes information in binary. And so those digital processors, of course, have tremendous power nowadays, and they've evolved, you know, since the very early processors back in, well, I guess very early processors, depends how far back you want to go. There were mechanical computers centuries ago that could process digital information mechanically, which sounds a little bit strange to us nowadays in the modern era. But then there were, of course, various types of computers, probably famously right around World War II, that were developed, say, to solve the German Enigma code during World War II. And those were running on not transistors. Transistors hadn't been invented quite yet, but they were running on vacuum tubes. And they're able to solve problems that people couldn't do by, you know, pencil and paper, and importantly help win World War II for the Allies. But then the transistor was developed in, not too long after World War II, and quickly became a critical part for building digital computers. And the field has of course advanced to the point where we are now, where the processor inside my smartphone, your phone, has something like 10 billion transistors inside of it to allow us to do all the incredible things that our phones and our laptops and such can do nowadays. So why would we want to build something different? Well, a quantum computer would be something that would operate in a completely different way. And you know, despite all these advances in modern computing, digital classical computing, there's still lots and lots of problems that people, companies would love to be able to solve that we just can't compute on our modern computers, that are what are called hard problems, that as the problem gets a little bit bigger in size of scope of what you're trying to solve, just the time it takes for a conventional classical digital processor to solve it just blows up, and it, you know, you'd have to run it for years and years or centuries or even millennia or more to solve that particular problem. And so these kind of problems come in a lot of different areas. Some of them come down to things like solving optimization problems. So like say you're a delivery company, like a UPS or a FedEx or the Postal Service, and you're trying to schedule routes for, you know, delivery trucks to go around to different parts of a city and a surrounding region to make deliveries, and you want to do this as efficiently as possible. So you have to schedule, you know, one truck to go to point A, pick up something, go to point B, go to C and D, and then another truck to do another set of routes. That turns out to be a really hard optimization problem to solve. And it takes sort of brute force numerics of classical computers sort of churning it out, and it's hard. Whereas certain types of quantum computers could potentially solve that problem much more efficiently. Another key area is I've listed down here at the bottom. So let's say you're a pharmaceutical company and you're trying to develop a new drug to hopefully cure some disease that we would like to solve. And discovering new drugs is difficult. It's not so easy to model how a new type of biomolecule would interact inside a person. So you have to sort of, you know, try different combinations and see what works, see what doesn't. But with a quantum computer, you could potentially quantum mechanically, you could model the quantum behavior of the molecules themselves and study how they say their reaction rates inside different biological solutions. So how a drug would dissolve in a person and how it might interact with different biological processes inside a person. So you could potentially discover new drugs very quickly, much more efficiently. The same thing applies to, say, discovering new materials, say materials that are maybe stronger or lighter, could be discovered much more efficiently than we have nowadays. There's also applications in cryptography. So sending information back and forth securely is something that's critically impacted by quantum computing. And so I've said the word several times now, you know, quantum computing. So what is quantum computing? Well, again, it involves building a system where the individual objects, these bits, instead of being digital objects, like in our conventional classical computers that are only a zero or a one, They're objects that follow the laws of quantum mechanics, and they follow some of the really strange properties of quantum mechanics that have been around with us, well, forever, but they've only really been known about since the initial development of quantum mechanics, which is, okay, it's all, everything's relative, but, you know, quantum mechanics was really worked out in the early part of the 20th century to describe things that physicists at the time couldn't understand. And so it turns out to describe the world down at the atomic scale, so the world of individual atoms, individual electrons, classical physics that had been, you know, developed very successfully up through the end of the 19th century, that worked great for describing how, you know, planets orbit stars and how all sorts of things we might hold in our hands, sort of the macroscopic world, how that worked. All of those laws seem to break down when you get down to this atomic scale. And so there needed to be a new field developed to explain how the world works at these really small length scales. And it turns out when you put together that theory, which is enormously successful for describing any experiments that have been done with atoms, with molecules, with electrons, there's some pretty strange consequences that violate our sort of common sense intuition that we have up in the macroscopic world of people. And so I'll just describe a few of those here. One of them is the idea of quantum superpositions. So a quantum mechanical object is able to actually exist in two different states at the same time, which sounds kind of strange, and it is. But normally when we're teaching quantum mechanics in a classroom or studying it, we're thinking about that in the context of, say, a single electron or a single atom, which maybe doesn't sound so weird to us because as humans, we're not used to thinking about what a single electron might be doing at any given time or a single atom. So, okay, we're willing to suspend our disbelief and accept that it's weird, but it is strange to think of some object that can be, say, in two different places at the same time, and really not sometimes one, sometimes the other, but really doing both things at once. So that's the idea of a quantum superposition, and it's kind of weird. Another idea, another key element of quantum mechanics that's going to play a role is something called quantum interference. So the idea that a particle that's following laws of quantum mechanics can go along, say, two different paths, and it can interfere with itself along those two different paths, so that in some cases, the interference can cause it to increase the probability that something happens, say that the particle ends up at a certain location, or they can interfere what's called destructively, and they can decrease the probability that it ends up at a certain place. And so that's, again, not something we have to worry about in our lives up at the scale of human beings. We don't have to worry about objects interfering with themselves and sometimes disappearing and sometimes reappearing. And the third aspect I'll mention that's especially strange and especially outside of our realm of common sense is something called quantum entanglement, which is something that applies when you have more than one quantum mechanical object. So let's say two. A quantum entangled state is a situation where you have two objects that are linked together in a very, very strange way so that they can't be described by the state of either object on its own. You can only describe it as a state of the whole of the two particles or more than two particles. And so this has especially strange consequences, which bothered, I should say, all of these aspects of quantum mechanics that I mentioned bothered the pioneers of quantum mechanics, including people like Einstein, who was especially disturbed by this idea of quantum entanglement, because quantum entanglement implies that if you have these two entangled objects, you could measure one of them and you could immediately know how a measurement of the other one is going to turn out, even if those two objects are very, very far apart, even to the point where, you know, one of them could be on the Earth and one of them could be on the moon or even in another galaxy. You would instantaneously know how that measurement somewhere far, far away is going to turn out. And that bothered Einstein because it seems like that would give you a way to suddenly transmit information instantaneously, which instantaneously means, you know, zero time, no matter what the distance is, which means something is happening faster than the speed of light, which he knew very well. He sort of explained shouldn't happen. And so for many years, these weird aspects of quantum mechanics weren't really focused on. I mean, people, the pioneering scientists back in the 1920s and 30s who figured out how to build this quantum mechanical theory and how to explain how atoms and electrons work, knew about these things. Einstein, with some colleagues, wrote a famous paper talking about how something had to be wrong, something had to be missing from quantum mechanics, because quantum entanglement was just crazy and the world couldn't work that way. But then these effects sort of sat in the background for many decades. They kind of got a little bit swept under the rug as sort of, okay, maybe these are weird sort of philosophical aspects of quantum mechanics, but the fact is quantum mechanics works great for explaining how things work at the atomic, at the molecular scale. So let's just use it. And there was an attitude that some have described as something called shut up and calculate, which was sort of in the field of physics for people studying quantum mechanics, just to say that, okay, there are these weird things that seem, you know, they violate our common sense. But the fact is this theory works. So just shut up and calculate, use it to figure out how your system, how these atoms fit together and how the spectrum coming out of this material works out, and the theory does its job. And so it was only a little more recently, say maybe in the 1960s and then going into the 70s, where physicists started to come back and say, hey, wait a minute, these really are strange things, and we should try to understand, you know, maybe this points to something a little deeper. And those sorts of problems led to people looking at both, all three of these aspects that I mentioned, but especially this weirdest one, the quantum entanglement idea. And there was a physicist named John Bell, who had thought deeply about this quantum entanglement problem, and the concerns that other people had raised, like Einstein. And he was able to make some predictions about how experiments should work if you could actually, say, prepare two objects, two quantum mechanical objects, in one of these entangled states. And at the time, you know, part of the reason these sort of weird aspects were people didn't really focus on them was because there was no way people could study a single atom or a single electron or make a pair of electrons that they could measure directly. It was just, you know, things are way, way too small. So the technology wasn't there. So that was part of the reason people were able to sort of push them off to the side and say, okay, let's focus on what works here. Let's not worry about these really strange details that come up with when you think about a single electron doing two different things at once, or two electrons being entangled in this weird state. But John Bell in the 1960s again, was actually able to make some predictions that could sort of, if a person could do an experiment, could test and see if quantum mechanics was right, that this entanglement effect was real, or if Einstein was right, that there had to be some extra piece of quantum mechanics that hadn't been discovered yet to explain how the world really worked in these kind of quantum entangled states. And when John Bell made these predictions, the technology still wasn't there yet to do this. So it was really just, he put forth this theory and said, you know, if you could build this, you could test these strange things and establish once and for all, is quantum mechanics the real way to describe the universe? Or is there something else that needs to be added in? And not too much later, in the 1970s, there actually was some initial technology developed that could look at these effects of entanglement. And those experiments were done first in the 1970s and then more carefully about a decade later. So we're sort of progressing historically here into the 1980s. And they were done with photons, so individual quanta of light. And what these experiments showed was if they followed this theory of John Bell, that they behaved exactly as quantum mechanics predicted. And this quantum entanglement was really a real effect. And you could really get these strange correlations between measurements in one location affecting the outcome of a measurement in another location, no matter how far away they were separated. And so in this sense, quantum mechanics was sort of vindicated. That's the way to describe the world, and it's weird, and it's something we just have to work with. And so those experiments have been extended over the years, and now the record for the distance, longest distance of two entangled particles being measured, is something like a few hundred kilometers. There was an experiment done just a few years ago by a Chinese research group where they had a satellite orbiting the Earth that was able to send out entangled pairs of photons, so these quanta of light, and measure them at two stations on the ground in China. They were a few hundred kilometers apart, and show that a measurement at one place directly affected the outcome of measurement at another place. So entanglement, even though it's really, really weird, is a real phenomenon. So that was kind of a long list of strange properties of quantum mechanics. And part of the reason I wanted to get into that was all of those aspects that I listed, sort of the idea of quantum superpositions, quantum interference, and quantum entanglement, all play a key role in trying to build a quantum computer. So if we can make our computer out of individual objects that follow the laws of quantum mechanics and can do all of these strange things, then we can build a completely new type of computer that can then solve problems that are just impossible to solve on a classical conventional digital computer. So how has this field evolved? Well, so in the early 2000s, even late 90s, but early 2000s, when people first started thinking about trying to build a quantum computer, this was mostly something that was done in academic research labs, say at universities or at national labs. And I had the good fortune of being sort of in the right place at the right time when I finished my PhD in 2000, right in the very early days of quantum computing. And I was able to move to a postdoctoral position at UC Berkeley in a lab that was trying to build some of the circuits that could form a quantum computer in the very early days. So I was just really lucky with timing that I was able to sort of get into the field at the ground floor. But now over the past several years, really the past decade, it's not been only academics and national labs that have been working on this, but there's been a lot of corporate activity in trying to build these sorts of quantum computers. And so I just highlight a few of these here. So Google has a really large team working on a hardware team. So we mostly think of Google, you know, as maybe a software company focusing on search engines and making, you know, crazy searches of all sorts of things on the internet. But Google also has a very large hardware operation that's based in Santa Barbara, California, to try to build one of these quantum computers. IBM has an even bigger team, mostly based down in New York at the Watson Lab in Yorktown Heights. And there's other companies too. So Northrop Grumman, Microsoft, Raytheon, Intel, all of these companies realize this as, you know, it's really a next big thing that they need to get involved with. And, you know, part of the reason companies are pursuing this is, you know, we talked about the really incredible advances in digital classical computing over the years. So we go from, you know, a single transistor back in the late 1940s, that was this heroic effort done at Bell Labs in New Jersey, to now, you know, our modern technology that has, you know, close to 10 billion of those transistors inside of it. Why would we need to do something different? Well, part of the way we get up to 10 billion transistors in each of our phones is making them smaller and smaller, so that now the size of an individual transistor is tiny. There's something like 10 or 20 nanometers across, where one nanometer is one billionth of a meter. So you need things that small if you're going to pack that many of them into a little chip that's going to fit in a phone that goes in somebody's pocket. The problem is, at some point, we reach a limit where you can't keep making the transistors smaller and smaller. So there's an effect that was observed by someone in the computing industry, Gordon Moore, a few decades ago, that's now famously called Moore's Law, that predicts how the sort of the scale of classical digital computing improves over the years. It's predicted to, his observation at the time that sort of turned into a prediction, was that this computing power improves exponentially every year. But an exponential growth can't go on forever. Eventually, and pretty soon, you know, it turns out you're talking about sizes of transistors that are smaller than individual atoms, or numbers of transistors that are, you know, ridiculously large. And so these exponentials always have to taper off. And so people always talk about the approaching end of Moore's law. And we really are starting to approach that, because transistors keep getting smaller and smaller, and we just can't make them any smaller. And so there's just a limit to how much classical computing power we can pack into a chip. But companies, all these big companies that are listed here, can see that, you know, quantum computing is now this way to sort of go around classical computing to make a completely different type of processor, where we don't necessarily need to have, you know, 10 billion transistors, 10 billion bits. We could potentially do something extremely world-changing with a much smaller number of quantum bits. The challenge is it's really hard to do. And so, you know, what one thing just highlighted here, this top news article, it's from now almost 2 years ago. One thing that was in the news was that the Google quantum computing team demonstrated a processor that they had built that didn't have 10 billion bits in it. It had 53 bits, quantum bits, though. So not digital bits, but quantum bits in it. And they're able to run a calculation on it that took about 200 seconds, you know, so a few minutes, three and a half minutes or so. But they were able to show that if you were to try to do that same calculation on a classical, digital classical, even a supercomputer, that it would take something like 10,000 years to do that same calculation. Of course, they couldn't prove that. They didn't have a supercomputer that they could run for literally 10,000 years. It'd be kind of hard to do that experiment. But they could extrapolate and show that if you were to do that calculation on a conventional computer, it would take 10,000 years. So that was a pretty big distinction, and that got people pretty excited. Okay, so you know, I mentioned that there's a lot of companies working on this, big technology companies. There's interest in this, not just in the US, but worldwide. So you know, this is recognized as a really key development. These quantum computers are potentially extremely powerful. They're really hard to make, but it's worth the effort for the potential payoff, right? If we can have new ways to, say, discover new drugs that help humanity, new ways to make new materials that help us build better things, you know, stronger bridges, stronger cars, airplanes, whatever, or solve hard problems like you know, delivering things more efficiently, saving fuel, saving the environment, all the things that are important to us as human beings could potentially be impacted if quantum computers that are large enough could be built. China has been investing extremely heavily. They've been building up really rapidly over the past 10 years or so. Europe's had several large projects. This was already a couple years back. They invested, you know, over $1 billion to build this large European flagship operation. So, you know, worldwide, this is recognized as a critical area of research. And in the U.S., you know, besides big companies getting involved, the U.S. government has been making a big push for the past several years to try to build up investment in quantum computing so that the U.S. can really stay at the forefront of the field. This has been, as this article sort of highlights, a rare instance of bipartisanship these days. Something just a few years back, Republicans and Democrats pretty much agreed on that the U.S. needed to really be very active in this area. And there was an act called the National Quantum Initiative that was signed several years ago that directed funds to build up large national research centers, some of them run by the National Science Foundation, some of them run by the Department of Energy, and some of them at NIST, the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, which is within the Department of Commerce in the US government. There's also money directed towards the defense agencies that are also very interested in understanding how a quantum computer could work. And then there have also been proposals, and there have been now since these this funding start just a few years ago, there's also been talk and activity on more funding for also research at universities, other national labs, and also just in investments in the country and building up these advanced technology priorities, as the statement says here. Okay, and so, you know, we talked about these big technology companies maybe not Google so much, but say companies that we think of as building computers, like IBM, like Intel, like Microsoft. But other companies that we've heard of before, but maybe we don't think of normally in the world of computing, like, okay, Volkswagen, we don't think of them as a computing company, or JP Morgan Chase, you know, maybe we pay our credit card bill to them or something. But all these sorts of companies are now getting involved in both working with some of the computing companies, like working directly with places like IBM, but also hiring their own staff of people who are experts in quantum computing to figure out what kind of role a quantum computer in the not too distant future might play at a company like Volkswagen. In their case, they're interested in trying to come up with ways to solve those hard optimization problems I was talking about for, say, doing navigation, say for routing buses and things through a big complicated city with, you know, traffic changing and construction going on and all sorts of things, obstacles that you have to route around. In the case of JP Morgan Chase, they're just an example of one of the many financial companies that's realizing quantum computing is going to play an important role in the future in, you know, financial modeling and figuring out financial risk and how to invest and these sorts of things. And then I mentioned already in the pharmaceutical industry, there are lots and lots of companies are building up expertise in quantum computing because they realize that it could be a really key way in the future to discover new drugs and to come up with cures for diseases that are a big problem. So this is just some of the little bit longer term outlook for how the quantum computing industry is expected to expand and what its footprint might look like. So I wanted to say a little bit, without getting too technical, about how you might go about building a quantum computer. And so, you know, we talked about quantum mechanics having these weird aspects of superpositions and interference and entanglement. And so to build a quantum computer, we need to harness those weird aspects of quantum mechanics. And we need to build objects that can follow those laws and have those properties. So one way of doing it might be just to build your computer out of individual atoms. And that's one of the leading approaches now for building a quantum computer. It's something called a trapped ion quantum computer. So where each quantum bit, or what we call qubits, is an individual atom that's held inside of a very, very good vacuum chamber where almost all of the air molecules have been pumped out of it. And it's held there by oscillating electromagnetic fields. And then it's addressed with pulses of laser beams that are focused right on those atoms. And then the state of it is measured with really, really weak pulses of light that are given off by that individual atom. And so that approach has a lot of potential because, you know, you're already dealing with individual atoms. So these are things that are normally described by quantum mechanics. The problem is you're dealing with individual atoms. It's not easy to, you know, take a single atom and put it in one place and know right where it is and shine a laser beam on that one atom and collect light coming off from that one atom. But nonetheless, that approach has gotten pretty far. And there's a lot of effort in that direction, especially in national labs. But there's also two pretty big companies, Honeywell being one of them, that work on trying to build quantum computers that way. But the other big approach, and the approach that I work on, and that most of the companies that I listed earlier, in fact, all the ones I listed earlier, so Google and IBM, Northrop Grumman, is based on a more solid state approach. So something a little closer to the processes that are inside of these, so that the transistors that are in our phones and our laptops. But instead of using materials that are made out of semiconductors, so the transistors in our phones are made out of silicon, a material that's a semiconductor. If we instead use materials that become superconducting, which means below a certain temperature, all of the sort of electrical friction that causes any type of conductor normally to heat up if you put a current through it, a superconductor has no such electrical friction. So you send an electrical current through it and it doesn't heat up at all. So the idea is to make these circuits now out of superconducting electrodes. And then in that case, we're not working with atoms, well, we're working with lots and lots of atoms, but our qubits, our quantum bits are not single atoms, but they're artificial atoms. So we're trying to make circuits where each circuit could behave like a single artificial atom. And then in that way, we could now sort of by the virtue that we're fabricating these, we're using the same sorts of fabrication techniques that are used to make transistors and conventional digital processors. We can make lots of them. using the same sorts of technology that's been out there for many decades now to make 10 billion transistors in your iPhone processor. But we can use them to make these very special superconducting circuits to now form this artificial atom. So a key aspect of this is what we'll call microfabrication, the same sorts of processes that go into making transistors. But to make these work, I mentioned that to have superconductivity, we have to go down to low temperatures. And one of the superconductors that we use and that's built into the quantum processors that IBM makes and that Google makes is aluminum. So just regular aluminum, the same aluminum you'd have in aluminum foil to wrap around a hot dog at a baseball game, aluminum. If you cool it down to 1 degree above absolute zero, it becomes a superconductor. So at room temperature, it's shiny. If you made a strip of aluminum and hooked it between two ends of a battery, you'd have current going through it. It would get hot. But if you cool it down below 1 degree above absolute zero, it becomes superconducting. It loses all of its electrical friction. And 1 degree above absolute zero is very cold. So absolute zero is minus 273 Celsius, or about minus 459 Fahrenheit, for those of us that think in Fahrenheit. So really, really cold. And if we get down to within 1 degree Celsius of that point, aluminum enters this special state, and we can use it then to build these sorts of circuits. It turns out we have to get quite a bit colder than that to actually have the circuits behave like artificial atoms. So we need to go down to about 0.01 degrees above absolute zero, which is even colder. And to do that, we need special systems like this one here, which is something called a dilution refrigerator that we have in my lab. And they have lots and lots of these. If you were to walk into the Watson lab at IBM or go into the Google quantum computing research lab. And these systems can get down to these very low temperatures, and we can have our circuits running then on the bottom end of these down here. If we can do that, then we can get the circuits into the superconducting state, and we can now have them behave like artificial atoms. So cryogenic engineering is a key part of this. And then finally, we control these circuits not with pulses of light from lasers like you would if you were making your quantum computer out of individual atoms, but we need to control them with pulses of microwaves, so much, much lower energy scales. But if we can carefully control microwave pulses, then we can control the quantum superpositions and the quantum entanglement of these artificial atom circuits. And so just have a few more slides here now talking about sort of what we're doing at SU in this area. So as Sydney mentioned at the beginning, I've been here at SU since 2005, and I've built up a low temperature research lab where we have several different refrigerators that allow us to get down to these very low temperatures near absolute zero. And we also have lots of capabilities for doing microfabrication. So for making these sorts of integrated circuits using superconducting elements, we do a lot of work down the road in Ithaca at the Cornell Nanoscale facility, where they have one of the best academic clean room facilities for doing fabrication of these sorts of circuits, one of the best facilities in the country. So we're lucky to be pretty close by. And I'm not alone. At SU, in the physics department, I have two colleagues, Simon Catterall and Jay Hubisch, who work on theoretical quantum information science. So I'm very much an experimentalist. I like building things and making measurements. Simon and Jay are theorists. They like thinking about things. And so they come about it from, they're both by training particle physicists. So thinking about subatomic particles and what happens at, say, particle accelerators, like the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland that you may have heard out, where they collide particles together at extremely high energies and look at what comes out. So there are theorists who think about modeling these sorts of things, but recently they've begun to think about how quantum computing could be applied to this field of particle physics. They've also thought about really interesting and deep connections between quantum computing and quantum information and things like gravity, which is a force that is very important, but it's also something that is still not completely understood, how gravity works at the quantum mechanical level and how it's connected to things like black holes. Okay, so that's a connection that you may never have thought about between a computer and a black hole, but There are actually deep, interesting connections there. And then on the experimental side, we have one, I have a colleague who just joined us at the end of the summer, his name is Ivan Pechenevsky, and he is building up an experimental research lab just down the hall from my lab to also study different aspects of these superconducting quantum integrated circuits. And then at SU, this area of quantum information science has been recognized as sort of a key area that SU would like to continue to build strength in. And so there's a plan to hire several new faculty over the coming years in physics, also in the chemistry department, and also in engineering. So it's an exciting area with lots happening. And I'll mention, you know, we've been teaching courses in this recently, because this is something that all of our students in both undergraduate level and graduate level are really interested in learning more about. I've been, for the past few years, teaching a course called Quantum Computing Demystified. That's a very introductory course with almost no physics prerequisites, but that students have been interested to take to learn about these key concepts of quantum computing. And then one of my colleagues has been teaching a more advanced course at the graduate level and sort of senior undergraduate level on this topic. And people that have graduated, even just from my group, have gone out and gotten great jobs in the industry working on you know, trying to build quantum computers at all of these companies. So these new industries need to hire people. And so they need, you know, trained scientists and engineers. And so the university, SU, can really do a great job here in training these people to work in this exciting new field. But outside of the university, outside of SU, around Central New York, we also have some other great assets. One of them is just to the east of here, in Rome, so you know, 45 minute drive or so on the thruway, is the Air Force Research Lab, which is the center of research in quantum information science within the Department of Defense. And so they have lots of exciting projects and several really highly recognized experts working on different aspects of quantum information science. So superconducting circuits like what I work on. They have experts working on trapped ions. They have experts working on photonics, and also people working on applications of quantum computing. So developing algorithms that could run on a quantum computer. And besides that, there's also, we have some footprint here in Central New York in the quantum technology industry. So, you know, I mentioned low temperatures are critical for getting to these these artificial atoms superconducting circuits to work. And one of the leading manufacturers of some of this low temperature hardware is right here in Central New York also, a company called Cryomac. So if you go around to any quantum computing lab around the world, whether you go down to IBM, you go over to Europe somewhere, Japan, China, you'll see systems in it that say Cryomac, Syracuse, New York in them, which is always kind of neat. And so they build some of the hardware that goes inside just about all these cryogenic systems that are used. There's a company, Sonnet, that based here in Syracuse, started by alumni from the engineering college here, that focuses on modeling microwave properties of circuits that's used all the time by my research lab and a lot of the other quantum computing research groups. And then Microsoft, that we don't normally think of quite as a Central New York company, right? They're based out in Seattle, but they've been partnering with SU and with the city of Syracuse in the Smart Cities Initiative. So they're very much interested in quantum computing. So let me just conclude here with this last slide. So you know, what's the vision for this? So we already have some strength and some activity at SU, and we have all these assets in the region. You know, the Air Force Lab, we have the Cornell Nanoscale Facility, we have other universities nearby, and we already have some companies that are working in this direction. So you know, at SU, we're hoping to continue to build up this activity, this exciting research area for, you know, just the academic and, you know, intellectual challenge of it, but also for training new scientists and engineers to work in this field. We'd like to continue to build up our collaborations across New York State with other labs, with companies, with other universities, and build up this you know, technical, scientifically trained workforce. And then the hope is that this can sort of form a nucleus and attract new quantum technology companies, you know, startups. There's startups all the time in this field because it's really on an upward trajectory. and convince them that, that Central New York is really a great place to be, and to really make an impact in this exciting new area. So I think I'll stop there. Hopefully I didn't talk for too long, and I'm happy to take questions.
Britton, thank you. We do have a couple of questions. The first question, how did people know that quantum entanglement existed? What proof was there?
That's a great question. So in the, trying to think of the year, I think it was right around 1930 when Einstein had thought about this, and Schrodinger before him. So Schrodinger was one of the other key pioneers of quantum entanglement. So again, yeah, they couldn't do these experiments. They couldn't even imagine somebody taking two atoms or two electrons and putting them in this entangled state. But they could think about, you know, if you somehow could do that, how would things behave? And so Schrodinger was able to show, if you apply the laws of quantum mechanics that he and others had just recently worked out to a system of two particles, then you would end up with this really strange entangled state. And then it would have these, he hadn't thought so much about the weird properties of it. You could say that it seems kind of funny, but then Einstein was the one who pointed out this really weird aspect of it, that it seems like it violates relativity. It seems like you're able to transmit information faster than the speed of light. And in fact, in the 70s, I think there were people who claimed that they even tried to patent things that would allow you to communicate faster than the speed of light with quantum entanglement. And that seemed kind of nutty, and people said, that can't be right. But for a while, nobody could quite put a finger on where the problem was. And then some people would argue that thinking about that problem, why that wouldn't actually work, kind of led to the development of quantum computing. And it turns out you can't communicate faster than light. So in case you were wondering, you can't build a walkie-talkie that uses entanglement and sends messages faster than light. And again, this is a weird aspect of quantum entanglement. The interactions happen instantaneously. So as soon as you make a measurement here of one quantum particle, its entangled partner, no matter where it is, even if it's on the other side of the galaxy, will instantly, you'd be able to predict what's going to happen. But the problem is you wouldn't be able to send a message that way, because to a person on the other side of the galaxy with that entangled particle, they wouldn't know anything about how your measurement turned out. To them, their measurement would seem random. They would only know that it was perfectly correlated with your measurement once you both got on the phone or sent an email to each other and said, you know, my measurement came out this way, and they could say, oh, mine came out this way. Isn't that neat? But to do that, if you call them on the phone, that's something that doesn't travel faster than the speed of light. So it's this very strange puzzle, but it all fits together, but it's definitely not the way we normally experience the world as human beings.
Okay. We have a question. Are any of the private companies that you've talked about this morning investing in research at Syracuse University?
Good question. Yes. So I've actually worked with the IBM quantum computing team from about 2010 to 2020 or so. In that case, I guess it wasn't IBM directly investing. It was IBM initially, especially say 10, 12 years ago, the quantum computing effort at IBM, as with most companies, was much smaller. There were, you know, a few scientists there that were working on this, but it wasn't something that IBM had identified as, you know, something that was going to become a core part of their business model. And so at the time, the main funding for this came from the US government. So they were really in the much earlier stages recognizing, okay, this could be some big deal in at the time what seemed like the far off future. And they wanted to make sure that the government understood this. And you know, if a quantum computer was going to be built, they wanted to know how it could be built, or if it was impossible, they wanted to know that too. And they wanted to be in on the ground floor, especially they wanted to make sure, say, another adversary didn't make a quantum computer first and end up somehow dominating the field. So the government was supporting research, both at universities, but also even at companies. So I was funded through a large government contract where IBM was the lead institution. And then they were subcontracting to my lab at SU. And that was from one of the agencies that Sydney, that you mentioned at the beginning, IARPA, which so ARPA stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency. And many of you may have heard of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency that that funds, you know, very far out research of interest to the defense industry. IARPA is the I, it stands for intelligence. So they're very interested in, you know, can a quantum computer be built and, you know, how's it going to work? So, I've worked very closely with IBM on that.
Britton, how soon will quantum computers be available and affordable to the general public?
Good question. So, and actually that's something I probably should have talked about a little more earlier. Quantum computing, you know, despite all of the potential promise for it, the, you know, this idea of maybe having a computer that could discover new drugs or materials or solve optimization problems, it's not going to displace classical computers. We're all still going to have our phones that are classical phones. We're still going to have laptops that are classical laptops. Lots and lots of computing is still going to be done classically the way it is now. Quantum computers are going to be focused on these certain key problems. And as you can imagine, you know, I was describing the way we're building a quantum computer, or parts of a quantum computer in my lab, and the way the IBM and the Google systems work, they require these very specialized refrigerators. It's not something that's going to sit on a person's desktop and definitely not go in a person's pocket in their pants. It's going to be something that's based in a giant research lab that would be connected to through the cloud. So in terms of the size of these things, you know, I mentioned in the beginning, Google had this breakthrough experiment just about 2 years ago now, where they had 53 quantum bits in it. And IBM has systems that have something slightly bigger than that, 60 or 70 or so quantum bits right now. Both of those companies and other players in the industry are projecting within the next couple of years being at the level of hundreds, a few hundred quantum bits. But then they're trying to rapidly advance so that a few years past that, they'll be at the thousands level. And the question is, how many do you need? And how many you need depends on what you want to do with it. So for some problems, it might be possible to really make meaningful progress with just a few hundred qubits. So really where the field is almost now. For other problems, you probably need several thousand, which might be another, you know, 5 or 6 years from now. And for other problems, you might need millions of qubits, which is a good ways off, maybe say a decade or so. Just because these things are not, they're really, you're trying to make objects behave like atoms and try to do these strange quantum mechanical things. The problem is there's a good reason why we don't experience those strange quantum mechanical effects in our lives. And it's because of what's called decoherence. So we don't ever, you know, hold a baseball and somehow see it in two different places at the same time, right? Or throw a baseball and see it go through a wall, which could happen quantum mechanically. You can have objects that can go through something that they would be forbidden to go through. There's some probability for them to actually make it through. So all those weird kind of things don't happen in our macroscopic world because of decoherence. But one thing I should mention, you can actually use quantum computers now. Any of you are welcome to, I'm not welcoming because I'm not able to offer this service, but I guess I'm advertising what IBM and Google and some other companies do. They make some of their processors available to anyone over the cloud. So if you Google, well, that's kind of a funny thing. If you look up the IBM Quantum Experience as one example, they have processors. They started doing this about 5 years ago. They have a very small scale quantum processor running in one of the refrigerators at the Watson Lab in Yorktown Heights. It started out with 5 quantum bits in it, but they made it available to anybody who could log in remotely from anywhere around the world and queue up a program. You know, it's a very rudimentary program if you're making it run on just 5 quantum bits, but you could actually run it on their machine and get results back and do it for free. And over the years, they've built up to larger and larger systems that they offer people this cloud access to for free. I think the current largest one you can access for free, it has 20 quantum bits in it. They have larger systems up to 50 or 60 quantum bits that people can pay for access to. I don't know that too many individual citizens pay for that, but there are companies that are interested in learning if quantum computing will be useful for them, that then, you know, make contracts with IBM to pay for cloud access. So I think that's kind of the model for how the field might go forward, at least in the near term, is not, say, IBM or Google making mass producing quantum computers that are going to get shipped and installed, you know, in people's basements or offices, but they're going to be in a lab, say at IBM or at Google, with people and other companies accessing over the cloud.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay.
And Britton, the question is, what does this technology mean for cybersecurity and privacy concerns?
That's an excellent question. So one of the early surprises that kind of kicked off the field and made people realize that quantum computing had some really strange power, that it seemed to be potentially able to solve problems that are just impossible to solve on a regular computer, is something called factoring. So factoring a large number into prime numbers, so prime numbers are things you can't divide down anymore. So like 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, so on. You can take any integer and you can write it as a product of prime numbers. But figuring out the prime numbers you have to multiply, like factoring that big number into prime numbers, is a really hard problem. And it's a problem that gets exponentially hard as you make the number longer and longer. And so there was a theoretical physicist and computer scientist back in the 90s who showed that if you could build a quantum computer, it could factor a huge number into primes very efficiently. Whereas if you try to do that classically, let's say if the number was something like a 1,000 digits long, it would take something like thousands of times the age of the universe for a regular computer to solve that. So that qualifies as impossible, right? None of us are going to wait around for 1,000 times the age of the universe. But a quantum computer could solve that same problem in hours or these days. So a huge, vast difference. And so that turns out to be a critical problem in cryptography. So when you say, send your credit card number over the internet to buy something from an internet company, your information, your credit card number, or if you do online banking, your banking information is encrypted. And the encryption scheme is based on that near impossibility of factoring large numbers into primes. It's very important that that security is maintained. We're a long way away from a quantum computer that could impact that security, but it means that lots of companies now are already thinking of other ways to do encryption so that in the future, they're still secure in the presence of quantum computing. But just from sort of a fundamental aspect of quantum computing, the fact that you could have this computer that could now solve this problem that's essentially impossible to do with a regular approach to computing in a reasonable amount of time, it is sort of this dramatic difference of scale in the computing time led people to realize that there's really something special going on in quantum computing.
Well, Britton, thank you so much. It was fascinating and informative, and we really appreciate you being here with us this morning.
Well, thank you.
A reminder to everybody that these lectures are recorded, and we do post them, the link to our webpage at the Office of Community Engagement at Syracuse University. And we also record them and have them available. And you can find those on WCNY's Thursday Morning Roundtable webpage. So thank you all. Have a great week and see you next week.